Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland Family Charitable Fund. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life, and by Cancer Treatment Centers of America in Philadelphia.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Maiken Scott. This time of year, when the days are getting so noticeably shorter and darkness seems to be setting in all around me, I feel sort of naturally creeped out, ill at ease. Add to that all of the Halloween decorations my neighbors are putting up, the skulls and spiders and ghosts. Ugh. It gets to me. Halloween comes from the Celts, who thought that the connection between our world and the world of ghosts and spirits got really thin around this time of year. So they had festivals to appease those ghosts and to put them in a good mood, so to speak. So I guess the thinking is you embrace that which scares you. And in that spirit, on today's show, we're going to explore things that are creepy, stuff that freaks us out. Alana Gordon is here now to start us off with our first story. And Alana, your story is really a story about facing your worst fears.
It is. So, Maiken, what's your worst fear?
Well, I'm afraid of most things because I really hate scary things, right? And I hate to be startled. I absolutely despise it. But I recently went to check out this massive haunted house type thing. It's on the campus of a former state institution. So there are crumbling old buildings all around. It's very dark. And first you have to walk through this stretch of woods to get there.
So creepy. I'm so creeped out right now.
You sound like you're having the time of your life.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So I was freaked out just being on the campus, right? But then I pushed myself to go into one of the haunted buildings. It's totally dark inside. There is fog everywhere and strobe lights so you can't see. Sudden loud noises and then people with gory makeup jump out and scream at you.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God. Can we go out?
Do you have your paper?
What's that?
Ah! What was it? What is it?
Oh my God.
It was awful. And I actually asked to be escorted out the back door after 3 minutes. And I hated it. I hated every moment of it.
So, Maiken, what if I told you that you had to face that fear? To do that, you have to go back in that house.
Ugh.
And like, you have to keep going back in that house for hours and hours and hours a day for several weeks.
I would have a really hard time with that. And it kind of sounds like, I guess, exposure therapy. That's what therapists do with people who have, let's say, a fear of heights or a fear of elevators. You just gradually expose people until they can take it.
Yeah, exactly. But imagine now that that fear or that thing that makes you most uncomfortable is within you. Imagine that it's pain.
What kind of pain?
A really, really debilitating kind that consumes your thoughts, your actions. For example, if I were to lightly touch you, like here.
Like on my hand?
Yeah, I'm just rubbing my finger on your hand. What does that feel like?
Like a finger on my hand.
Right. Well, for Savannah Fleeman of Mount Vernon, Iowa, it's totally different.
It's kind of hard to describe. It was sort of like being stabbed almost.
Just that little tiny touch on her hand?
Yeah. I talked to another teen with this kind of pain condition, Mary Kelly Shevlin of Kansas City, Missouri. And for her, even the slightest touch, on her feet especially, it can feel like a blowtorch.
It's almost like if you had like a really awful bruise or a really awful burn, but just your entire body is that. Everything that touches you, like clothes, sheets, it shouldn't hurt, and you know it shouldn't hurt, but it does.
For both of these teens, the pain got so debilitating that it completely consumed them by the time they were in high school. For Savannah, the pain worsened to the point that it put her in a wheelchair.
And I was gone from school so much and struggling to keep up.
And what's so hard is that there wasn't some like outside trigger that everyone could say, oh, this caused this. And there wasn't even some sort of like direct test where doctors could be like, oh, you have this. I can see this pain. It doesn't work that way. But both Mary Kelly and Savannah were later diagnosed with some form of amplified musculoskeletal pain syndrome, or AMPS. It's an umbrella term, but many also refer to these particular conditions as complex regional pain syndrome. And for people who develop it, like I was saying, the pain is excruciating. And what's so striking about this, to me, Mikan, is that the way to treat it can be really tough too, because it involves facing that pain and all the fears that come with it head on.
How so? What do they do?
So I recently went to check this out at this controversial clinic in Philadelphia at the Children's Hospital that treats patients with this syndrome. So the day I went there, I walked through a colorful exercise area. One patient's on a treadmill. Another's rubbing a stick of ice all over their bare feet.
We exposed them to lots of different textures and sensations that may bother them.
Dr. David Sherry runs the program. He's a rheumatologist, and he has been studying and treating this pain for over 3 decades. David stands out, even in this bright room, with his long white beard, zany ties, ridiculous jokes, and Chuck Taylor kicks.
High top, always black.
David says what makes this condition different from other types of chronic and acute pain, like when you break a bone, is that in this case, the pain takes on a life of its own. A pill or an operation won't work. Instead,
you override the pain signals to reset them. And you do that by stimulating the pain over and over and over until it settles down and resets.
So if light bothers you, sit in a bright room, work on a computer. If a slight brush of air on your skin feels like a blowtorch, step in front of this high-powered fan. Or if a small bump bothers you, like when you're in a car on a highway, well, lucky for you, next to that fan is a total body vibrator.
What I tell the kids, it shakes the bejesus out of you.
So if I, can I get on this?
Yeah.
This is a lot of vibration. This is not your typical physical therapy approach. It's not gradual. It's not about avoiding or easing into that pain. The in-clinic treatment part of this lasts about a month. Savannah, one of the teens I talked to, went to one in Kansas City that's modeled off of David's. There are about 8 like it around the country.
I was begging not to have to go back, and I was crying, and I was trying to stall all kinds of stuff to try to avoid going back.
She puked all over the dashboard on the drive home after the first day.
It was heartbreaking, I think, for both of us. It was very, very difficult.
That's Savannah's mom, Amy Robos. She wasn't allowed in during the day. None of the parents are. And as hard as this was, she encouraged Savannah to stick with it.
If we couldn't make it through this program, if this program didn't work for us, I was afraid that this was the best her life was ever going to be. And that was not okay with me.
Back inside the Philadelphia clinic, a couple patients are in gym clothes. They're sweating, and they're in a wide hallway that's painted green with line markers, like a mini football field. Physical therapists encourage them from the sidelines as they do animal walks.
Keep going. Keep feet.
This involves putting weight on a hand or foot that bothers them most.
Almost there.
It appears to be a real strain for one of them. Rheumatologist David Sherry says how these kids experience pain is different. Their nerve signals got caught in a loop that was then amplified after an initial stimulus. That might have been as trivial as a minor sprain from dancing or playing a sport. He likens what happens to when a microphone gets placed next to a speaker.
You get a high squeal. Well, that's a very soft sound that goes into the microphone. But then it comes out the speaker, goes in the microphone, comes out the speaker, goes in the microphone, and it becomes so painful, you have to leave the auditorium, you know, if they can't turn it off. So the same thing with these kids. You can't say, you know, this is just a light touch. I'm just barely touching your skin. Or, you know, your hair is brushing on your back. That can't possibly hurt. Yes, it can. Just like a very soft sound in the microphone, if it's too close to the speaker, can make you leave the auditorium.
For some people, this amplification results in physical signs. Blood vessels constrict, turning a hand or foot blue. Either way, this is where desensitization comes in. Like when you put your hand in a sink full of hot water or jump in a really cold pool, at first that might seem unbearable, But the idea is you get used to it.
Because pain usually means damage. And so what we have to retrain these kids to think that the pain is not damaging their body. And so they need to work through that fear to retrain the nerves.
The exact cause and trigger of this pain isn't clear. It's a rare condition, and the research is ongoing. David and others suspect genetics play a big role in combination with the environment and psychological stressors. It's often misdiagnosed. But to pediatric pain specialist Dr. Elliot Crane, this condition represents an important window into pain itself.
It captures so much of what pain is. It captures the actual physiology of pain. It encompasses the modulation of pain, either the amplification or the minimization of pain. It captures the psychological response to pain, all the anticipatory anxiety and fear and depression that chronic pain causes.
Crane is director of pain management at Stanford's Children's Hospital in California, where he treats this condition too. He says no question intense physical therapy and desensitization is a critical part of the process. But he worries that a hardcore boot camp approach can be too much for some kids.
If it's a child, that can be a very traumatic experience. Very, very traumatic.
Elliot's concerned that could induce more trauma, even PTSD.
It's not necessary for somebody to feel the pain to get better. It's not true that no pain means no gain.
Two lines, just two lines, just two lines.
David Sherry at the Philadelphia Clinic disagrees.
I think that to tell them, don't worry, you know, poor baby, you know, we'll just do this and we'll coddle you and we'll bring you along gradually, it is a disservice to them.
He admits this approach isn't for everyone, depending on someone's anxiety levels and other factors. For that reason, they've beefed up their safety and psychological protocols and supports throughout. But David says patients have to be pushed to get better, so they learn to stop letting the pain control them. Here's Savannah again, who completed a similar program in Kansas City.
Before, I honestly thought pain was just part of life. It was part of who I was, even if I hated that. It just seems like it never was possible for it to truly go away for me. And now it's gone.
Savannah's 17 now. She no longer needs the wheelchair. She still has to maintain a therapy routine, both physical and mental. But she's taking college classes now. She's volunteering, she's excelling, and living a full life.
It's totally weird and totally crazy, but in like this amazing, mind-blowing, miraculous way.
For Mary Kelly, the other teen I talked to who went through that same program, her pain, it's just as pervasive as it was before, if not more. But she says still, the clinic experience changed everything.
Yeah, the pain is the worst it's ever been, but it doesn't define me or control what I do. It's really good to feel that way, to like have something that controlled you for so long and then to finally be free of that is really an incredible feeling.
She says now she seeks out everyday teen activities. She dances, she's in theater, she's active and engaged. And unlike before, she doesn't hold back.
Alana Gordon reported this story. We're talking about facing our fears, and sometimes the stuff we're scared of turns up in our dreams and our nightmares. The most vivid dreams happen during a specific stage of sleep, REM sleep.
Your heart rate is elevated, your blood pressure rises, and you have all this neural activity going on in your brain.
That's neuroscientist Balan Jalal. He says that during REM sleep, you're lying in bed, your heart is beating, and all of these neurons are firing. The part of your brain that processes emotion, the limbic system, lights up so much that it looks the same as when you're awake. Some scientists think that the reason we dream is to make sense of all those random emotional fireworks. Other parts of our brain turn totally off during REM sleep, like the part that controls logic. That's probably why dreams so often don't make a lot of sense.
And then the priest said, and at that point, you have to get down and grovel. And I said, you mean get down on the floor and grovel? And he said, yes.
It was in this really creepy church and it was dark and there's lightning flashes outside. And I remember like realizing that I had been possessed and that I was going to do something horrific.
By the way, there's no real difference between a dream and a nightmare. A nightmare is basically just a dream that stresses you out. So do the crazy dreams that we have during REM sleep have a purpose? Here is neuroscientist Balan Jalal again.
So one theory for why we dream or even have nightmares is that it has a survival mechanism. So if you, in your dream, see yourself, I don't know, like wrestling with a bear or something, that is going to make you more likely to, when you encounter that in real life, be able to deal with a situation like that.
I don't dream about bears, but I do dream about being late for work or not being able to finish a project on time, and it's always stressful. But there is another kind of nightmare that sounds a lot worse than that.
You're completely paralyzed and you're half awake.
A feeling like I'm about to wake up. But then I realized that I can't move.
I knew the bathtub was overflowing.
And most of the time it's like someone like standing over your bed who's gonna murder you.
I often feel that there are people with me in the room.
And I also knew that there was a stranger wandering around the house.
The best way I can sum it up is like a feeling of suffocating.
I couldn't move to hide or defend myself against the stranger, and I couldn't get up to turn off the bath water.
It really is like my consciousness is stuck underwater.
Sometimes I can wake myself up by screaming.
This inability to move, the feeling of a presence in the room or pressure on your chest, it's called sleep paralysis. It's a glitch that happens during the REM sleep phase when you're having intense, weird dreams. And during that phase, all of us are paralyzed to stop us from acting out our dreams, maybe jumping out of a window if you're dreaming that you can fly.
A part of the brain in the brain stem totally paralyzes you during REM sleep.
But the people who get these horrifying nightmares, they are partially awake during REM sleep and their body is still unable to move.
The first thing you do is like, my God, let me get out of here, right? So you start sending all these command neurons down to your body, to your arms, to your legs, move, right? Move, move.
Your brain and your body are out of sync. So your brain is trying to construct some kind of narrative around what's happening to you. Maybe you'll hallucinate and think there is a presence in the room.
Your brain is free to freak you out in any way it knows how.
So what can you do to make it stop? Balan is studying that now. His advice?
Don't panic. Stay calm.
And tell yourself that sleep paralysis, like most everything else, can be explained by science. Balan Jalal is a neuroscientist at Cambridge University. Think about the last scary movie you saw and what it really was about that movie that freaked you out. Yes, it was probably the plot, but I'm sure it was also the music. Because so often that's what's really unsettling. A lone piano playing dissonant notes in the distance, or that kind of drum beat that lets you know something terrible is about to happen. But why do these tunes scare us so much? Max Green reports.
It's a dark and stormy night. You're home alone, ready to watch a scary movie. You turn off the lights and settle in with a bowl of popcorn. The opening credits flash on the screen. After a few minutes, you're engrossed, but suddenly thinking, maybe this wasn't such a good idea. You're looking over your shoulder every few moments, and you're hyper aware of the sounds around you. A tree branch tapping softly at the window, a creaking floorboard, a metal gate swinging back and forth outside. You're on edge. But nothing scary has actually happened yet on screen, so why is the hair on your neck standing up? It may be all the cues your ears are picking up on that your eyes haven't. Sound cues that tell you tension is rising and something is probably going to happen soon.
The ear in general has a far more direct line to your emotional response.
That's Kublai Uner. He teaches music composition for the screen at Columbia College Chicago. He says in scary movies, the ear plays a big role in creating fear.
I think it has to do with the fact that it's always on. You can't close your ears. And it's the only thing that can look behind you. That's one of the reasons why it plays such a big role in scaring people in movies.
Kublai says composers can use sound design and music to make the viewer feel unsettled.
Basically, what you're trying to do is somehow take away the sense of safety and control from the audience.
But when it comes to music, context is key. Notes and combinations of notes aren't objectively creepy sounding. Rather, horror movies have given us a kind of language that's taught us to fear certain tones. Kublai uses a piano in his classroom to explain.
Complicated intervals can sound what we commonly call dissonant, and they can be employed to be scary. So you have something like this. And out of context, that sounds a little scarier than...
But take that same dissonant chord and add a few notes in the middle.
I can make it kind of pretty and more like a question mark.
Music composers have lots of strategies at their disposal to facilitate different kinds of scares. Take Alfred Hitchcock's classic Psycho, for example.
Where it's just horrific, employing almost a physical gesture. Those screechy violins that keep coming, wee, 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 is really just painting the movement of somebody with a knife stabbing, and you have that high sound which suggests metal.
And then there are brooding low tones, what you might expect to hear looking down a dark hallway or across open water, like the incessant rumble in Jaws. And a common one these days, the twisted reality scare.
Distorting to expectations. Something that should be nothing but good turns into the opposite.
A good example is the lullaby theme from one of my favorite horror flicks, Rosemary's Baby.
You have these many primal ways of scaring people acoustically. And I think it has to do with the function that we're used to using our ears as alarm mechanisms.
Science tells us Kublai's theory isn't far off from the truth. All of those elements he mentioned scare us for a reason. It's why we use words like primal or visceral to describe fear. Scary sounds act as a stimulus and evoke a biological response from our bodies. Daniel Blumstein studies evolution and biology at the University of California in Los Angeles, and he's curious about why certain sounds evoke this fear response in people. But he's not a fan of horror movies. What got him thinking about this was much cuter.
Marmots.
Marmots are kind of like big squirrels.
And through a serendipitous experience I had, I was holding a baby marmot, and suddenly it screamed, and I had this emotional response. And I wondered why I'm having an emotional response to a rodent, you know, screaming.
And just for reference, this is what a screaming baby marmot sounds like. Daniel says when he heard that, his body reacted, his heart skipped a beat, and he started thinking,
maybe there's a general principle at play that can help us understand why we respond certain ways to certain types of music and certain types of soundtracks.
So he started looking at the screams on spectrograms. That's kind of a visual representation or voice print of different sound components.
And what was striking about marmot screams is they illustrated things that bioacousticians would call nonlinearities.
Nonlinearities in sound occur when a system, like vocal cords in a marmot or speakers in a stereo, are overblown. Think of those jarring, noisy squeals and distortions that come out of a broken speaker.
Raspy, staticky. Some of these may be rapid frequency upshifts and rapid frequency downshifts, which might come across as warbles.
He found that noisy sorts of sounds naturally produced by vocal cords in alarming circumstances make us feel afraid.
I think the people that have been making films and music have implicitly known this, but what our work has shown is sort of the reason why. And this hypothesis links us to our ancestors, not just our human ancestors, but our non-human ancestors.
Kublai Uner, the music professor, says that makes sense to him. As a film composer, he plays with the timeless tools that help spook audiences. But he says cultural context changes over time. Music that scared people 100 years ago, like this Bach toccata, which might conjure images of Dracula, sounds a bit kitschy today.
One of the problems that you have as a composer is that everything that works tends to lose potency. And so you have to reinvent the wheel with some regularity.
So remember, people like him are out there, right now, trying to scare you. And biology is on their side. For The Pulse, I'm Max Green.
When we're scared, watching one of those movies or just listening to Max Green talk in that scary voice, our body goes on high alert. Our heart rate speeds up, and so does our breathing. And it's not just what you're feeling. Other people can pick up on those signals, too.
Big eyes and raised brows and this little grimace. Our bodies will get tenser. They'll often sort of shrink down a little bit. We even smell different when we're frightened.
That's psychologist Abigail Marsh. Her book is The Fear Factor, and she's been researching an interesting correlation between the ability to detect fear in others and two polar opposite personality types. What she's found is that people who are very altruistic or benevolent are really good at detecting other people's fear. Psychopaths, on the other hand, are terrible at reading this emotion.
That's right. So I and other researchers as well have studied people who are psychopathic and have found that they're really bad at detecting when other people are afraid. So if you show them what to most people would look like a really vivid, fearful facial expression, they have a lot of trouble detecting what it is. In fact, one of my colleagues in England tells a great story of a psychopathic felon that she was interviewing. And she had showed him a whole series of facial expressions, and he'd missed every single fearful expression. And he got the last one, and he knew he was doing badly, and said when he saw it, you know, I don't know what that expression is called, but I know that's what people look like right before you stab them. So he knew he'd seen this expression before, and he could even come up with where he'd seen it, but he couldn't link it to an emotion.
But why does that lack of recognition lead to psychopathic behavior?
Well, the idea is that if you can't recognize what somebody else is feeling, that's an index for the fact that you can't really understand that emotion in other people. And part of the problem with people who are psychopathic is that they don't experience fear strongly themselves. And so they're literally having trouble empathizing with that emotion in other people. And so because of that, they don't really understand why it's even bad to make people feel frightened.
We use the term psychopath sort of loosely in our society, but how is it defined for your work? What is a psychopath?
That's a great question. Yeah, the word psychopath has come to mean a lot of different things. People who study psychopathy usually boil it down. The sort of central thing that makes people who are psychopathic different is their insensitivity to other people's distress or suffering. But that goes along with a number of other things that are common in people who are psychopathic, including being manipulative, having some trouble with impulse control, and engaging in lots of different kinds of antisocial behaviors, including aggression that's not the result of, you know, frustration or a fit of rage, but that's sort of coolly, deliberately planned out to hurt other people.
And on the other side of that coin, because you have found that people who are very altruistic are better at recognizing fear, does that mean when we see fear in another person, there is a mechanism that makes us care and help that person perhaps?
Yeah, it seems like what happens when we see somebody else who's afraid is it kicks off this amazing little chain reaction inside our brain that ultimately leads us to care for the way that that person is feeling. And that chain reaction depends fundamentally on processes within the amygdala. So somehow the amygdala enables us to probably simulate what that person's feeling, create a little sort of internal shadow of what the feeling of fear feels like. And then in addition, probably with the help of this little hormone called oxytocin that is active in the amygdala, it also stimulates in us the desire to want to help the person who's feeling frightened as well. And depending on the person, how strong that motive to care is really varies a lot between people.
What does all of this mean, your findings, in terms of what we need to know about fear, how we relate to others? What are the big takeaway points?
One of the things I hope people realize about fear is what a useful emotion it is, not just from a self-preservation standpoint, but because our own ability to feel this emotion, which I think some people wish they didn't have, you know, it seems like it would be a nice thing to go through life fearless. And yet, our ability to feel this emotion allows us to connect with that same emotion in other people and leads us to care about other people who are in trouble. And so I think hopefully people will come away with a new appreciation for this sort of amazing emotion.
That's psychologist Abigail Marsh. Her book is The Fear Factor. Abigail just said fear is an amazing emotion, and I think part of that is because it's so nuanced. It warns us, but it can also challenge us in different ways. Facing your fears can be liberating or even thrilling. That's why people love roller coasters, right? Take a listen to this. A while back, we sent reporter Joe Hernandez to try a ride at Six Flags in New Jersey. It's called Zumanjaro, the Drop of Doom.
First, you wait in line.
I don't know.
Maybe.
Get strapped in.
I was like ready to get off.
Take the slow ride to the top of the tower, pause, and enjoy the view.
Now, I think I was about to pee on myself at that point.
And then, the drop. About 250 feet of free fall at 90 miles an hour. 5 seconds barreling straight down.
I feel everything just pushes up to your chest.
I didn't think my stomach was going to stop.
It's not quite floating, but it... kind of a scary floating.
So people love it, they hate it, they definitely get a kick out of this experience. Many of us seek out things that push our limits, skydiving, mountain climbing, but some choose edgier extremes. Paige Flager reports on a practice that might look scary, but those who do it say it releases a lot of bottled up emotions.
Inside a windowless warehouse, Kirsten Januszewski is lying on her back on a massage table. She's wearing a bra and bike shorts and has dots of black marker all over her body, on her collarbones, her ribs, her thighs, her kneecaps, and her shins. 5 people are standing around her with rubber gloves and surgical face masks on. They're each holding a large metal hook about the size of a coat hanger.
Everybody good?
Yep.
I'm on you, sweetie, whenever you're ready.
I'm ready.
Ready? Get your last breath out.
Each of them pinches Kristen's skin and lines the hook up with the dots of marker.
Just big deep breath from you. And out.
Then they drive the hooks through her flesh at the same time. Her eyes are closed and she's shaking.
Whoa.
Kirsten is here to do body suspension, basically to hang from the ceiling by those hooks in her skin.
People run because it's an adrenaline and endorphin rush, you know, it releases, you know, those good feelings. Suspension does the same kind of thing. It's all those same kind of internal natural drugs that happen with it.
Sometimes she suspends as a celebration of something good going on in her life. And other times, like this one, she's suspending because things have been really hard lately.
Suspension definitely helps start that movement, that, you know, more of a positive mental kind of attitude. It helps clear all that kind of negative emotions that I have going on.
She compares it to going to therapy, which would make this guy her therapist.
My name's Jeremy. My last name's Smart, the opposite of stupid. I'm actually the team leader for Skinthesis Body Suspension.
Jeremy came across body suspension years ago during a difficult time in his life. He's a veteran and was struggling with post-traumatic stress, so he decided to try it out. He remembers the first time when the hooks went in and they started lifting him up.
When my feet left the floor, it was like a nuclear bomb went off inside me, and it just like all everything just pushed out at like the speed of light, and I was just like just blown away by it. In a matter of minutes, my eyes were wider than they've ever been before, and then I felt completely rejuvenated and completely new and like a totally different human being.
He was, well, hooked. These days, every other weekend, he and his team meet at the warehouse and facilitate suspensions for other people for all sorts of reasons.
It could be the loss of a family member. It could be a relationship. You know, it could be the loss of a child. It could be the birth of a child. Nothing feels as good as being able to provide individuals with the means to kind of challenge themselves and overcome a lot of fears. All that negativity that's balled up and sits on your shoulders, it's like just letting the weight loose, you know. I need to defy gravity for a minute, and it's like it just nothing matters.
There hasn't been any research done on the impact of body suspension on the mind or the body.
I tried to peruse the medical literature if there was any comment or anything about it, and there wasn't really much that I could find.
That's dermatologist Jules Lipoff.
So I wouldn't want to overstate the risks. I wouldn't want to say you definitely can't ever do this, but medically, I can't really recommend it.
He has one main worry about body suspension.
Anytime there is a penetrating injury into the skin or any part of the body, there certainly is primarily a risk of infection. So even in the most sterile environments, like when we do surgeries or cut things out of the skin, still sometimes there are infections and risks.
Back at the warehouse, Kirsten Januszewski is ready to go. The hooks are dangling from her skin. Before she goes up, she's taking a quick smoke break.
I don't necessarily feel as strong as what I normally do, so this one's definitely making me nervous. But I know, you know, once I'm up, it's going to prove to me again that I am a lot stronger than I'm feeling.
She climbs back onto the table and assumes the position for her suspension, leaning back, one leg bent and the other straightened. Jeremy carefully loops a rope through the hooks, crisscrossing back and forth, forming a web between Kirsten and the rig hanging from the ceiling above her. The room is tense as the rig is raised slowly, pulling the hooks and stretching Kirsten's skin.
Nice big deep breath. Yeah, baby, you're there. Beautiful. Relaxing. All the way good. She's up. She's up. Get her up.
Her body leaves the table. Suddenly, she's floating in the air. Jeremy steps away, admiring Kirsten like a piece of artwork he's just created. She beams, letting her body relax. She hangs there for about 15 minutes, and Jeremy gently swings her the way a parent would a child on a swing set. She asks to come back down, and the moment her body hits the table, she begins to cry.
Let it out.
Jeremy kneels next to the table and holds her hands, encouraging her to let go.
Thank you guys very much. Thank you for making me cry too, I needed it. You know that feeling that you get after like a massage where you feel really, really light? Yeah, that's what you feel like. That's what I feel like. It just feels like my body is weightless right now. It's awesome.
Paige Flager reported this story. A while ago, I started noticing these weird videos online where you watch people do a mundane task and often somebody is whispering along, kind of narrating what's happening. The key term here is ASMR. It stands for Autonomous Sensory Meridian Response. We don't know how common this is, but people who experience this phenomenon report getting pleasant brain tingles when they are watching these videos, accompanied by a sense of well-being. So we wondered, is there any science to explain what's going on? Molly Siegel found some emerging research, but her reporting started close to home with her boyfriend.
When I got the email from Devin, I was confused. He sent me a link to a YouTube video. In it, we see a close-up of someone handling a parcel and then unwrapping it. The sound is sharp, emphasizing each crinkle. To me, it's boring. But my boyfriend says when he puts headphones on to listen to those kind of sounds, they're pure bliss.
The sound sort of will start in my, say, for example, my right ear. And that sort of translates into almost like this electric feeling that ripples across my scalp.
For him, it's a trigger video. It starts up those brain tingles.
Slowly, these sounds sort of start to culminate until eventually my whole scalp feels like it's lit up, like there's this electric sort of very low volt charge that sort of ripples across the whole thing. And then it puts me into this very relaxed state.
That ASMR unboxing video has more than 100,000 views. And there are lots of different trigger videos out there. A click of lenses during a refraction test at the eye doctor. The sound of scissors around your head at a barber shop. Soft whispering in your ear. But what's happening in your brain?
Hi.
to ask, I visited the Memory Disorders Clinic at St. Michael's Hospital in Toronto.
I'm Molly Siegel.
Where I met Luis Fornazzari. He's a neurologist who studies cognition, memory, and behavior.
But it's clear that it's in an area that is still in the early stages.
Luis hasn't conducted his own studies on ASMR, but he does see some similarities between ASMR and synesthesia, a neurological phenomenon that crosses connections in your brain. People with synesthesia sense things differently. They might experience a number as a color, for example. Luis thinks ASMR is similar.
It's a sensory experience. The different sensory stimulus are triggering totally different responses.
So someone with synesthesia might experience a taste when I experience a color or a sound. My boyfriend feels tingling in his scalp and his brain when he watches and listens to the ASMR trigger videos. But when I watch one, nothing. Neurologist Stephen Smith also sees similarities between ASMR and synesthesia. He teaches at the University of Winnipeg in Canada.
So my research looks at the neuroscience of emotion and how emotion captures our attention and influences how we move.
There isn't a lot of research on ASMR yet, but Stephen's team is one of the few with peer-reviewed and published research into the phenomenon. In their first study, they scanned the brains of 22 people. Half of them experience ASMR and the other half don't. To map the differences between the two groups, the scientists started with baseline brain scans while the subjects were awake, but not focusing on anything in particular. Even in that kind of doing nothing state, a team of neurons is firing in your brain. Let's call them Team A. The scientists found that in the brains of people who experience ASMR, not only were the Team A neurons firing, the neurons associated with attention and vision were also active. That's called crosstalk.
For people with ASMR, there's a much greater blending of those networks, so they're not quite as distinct as they would be in the rest of us.
Since then, Stephen and his team surveyed 580 people, half of them experience ASMR. Within that relatively small sample, the scientists discovered that people experiencing ASMR had certain personality traits. They were generally more open to new experiences. Stephen thinks that could explain why individuals feel ASMR in the first place. Their minds may be more open to those unusual brain tingles. The scientists also found people who experience ASMR are prone to neuroticism and more likely to have anxiety or depression.
There are a lot more ups and downs for people with ASMR, and they have to find some way to deal with it. And that might be why so many people use ASMR as a way to relax, because they're trying to find some way to cope with the ups and downs that they're experiencing.
Meanwhile, could someone like me, someone who hasn't experienced an ASMR response, ever have this feeling? I gave it one last shot and got my boyfriend to play me one of his favorite videos. I put headphones on. I close my eyes.
The guy has a bar of soap with some plastic packaging on it, and he's moving it in front of or around a special microphone.
I don't think this is going to do anything for me.
Yep, nothing. For The Pulse, I'm Molly Siegel.
So the research on ASMR and why some people enjoy these videos is still very new, but there is a lot of science on fear and why people sometimes enjoy the feeling of being scared. It can give people a natural high of sorts.
The chemicals that are released during fight or flight when our sympathetic nervous system is activated, they're the same that are released when we're excited or surprised or happy.
That's Margie Kerr, a sociologist who studies fear, and she says our enjoyment of this emotion has a lot to do with context. It's all about how we interpret the rush of endorphins.
You can even see it when somebody is watching a scary movie or going through a haunted house. They scream, but then within milliseconds, they're smiling and laughing, and you can see how they've kind of remembered, oh, I'm in a safe place. I'm not really in danger. And all of that energy, all of that excitement that went into the scream is now going into the laughing.
But sometimes fun scary turns into actually scary, as in legitimately terrified. So I asked people on Facebook, what movie put you over the edge?
The horror film that has left the most lasting impact on me is Nightmare on Elm Street.
That was then. This is now.
The Exorcist is the scariest movie I've ever seen.
This cruelty.
And I laid awake the entire night terrified. My sister actually took our Ouija board and threw it in the dumpster across the street from our house. I think I still may need some therapy to this day.
I can't say Freddy's full name. I can't look at pictures of him. I can't think about the movie in any detail.
For 2 months after, I had to move a light into the corner that I could see from my bed, or I wouldn't be able to sleep.
I'm freaking myself out right now.
Who is going to be scarred by which movie depends on the person, but sociologist Margie Kerr says kids are especially vulnerable.
You know, for really young kids, you know, kids who haven't reached the stage of development where they understand what is fake and what is real. So, you know, they may see a person in a witch costume and believe that they're really going to hurt them. So that's, you know, too young. At that age, too, we are remembering things that are scary really well. And that becomes, you know, the thing of future nightmares.
That kind of thing happened to listener Alex Schmidt. She had a really scary experience in a haunted maze when she was a kid. She had a panic attack. Employees had to pull her out through an emergency exit. But as an adult, she was able to get over that.
I decided to face my fears a couple years ago at an event called the Great Horror Campout in Los Angeles, where you camp out in tents overnight and monsters kind of come and drag you out of your tent and do all these really scary things to you. And believe it or not, it actually worked. After, you know, several hours of being in this situation, the monsters got kind of old and I got used to them and I had seen all of them multiple times and I was like, I know your deal, you're not scaring me anymore. And it actually kind of cured me. And now I sort of like haunted houses and I sort of like scary movies. So try and face your fears. It actually might cure you.
Probably true, Alex, but I have to say, when I was done going through that haunted house I visited, I could not wait to leave and never come back.
I see my car. Best noise ever. Phew. All right. Oh my God.
That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. You can find us on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Our health and science reporters are Alana Gordon, Irina Zhuroff, and Alan Yu. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Paige Flager and Alex Stern are our associate producers. Tanya English is our managing editor. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.
I am really glad to be out of there. Phew. All right.
Behavioral health reporting on The Pulse is supported by the Thomas Scattergood Behavioral Health Foundation, an organization that is committed to supporting innovative approaches in integrated health care. The Heron Lung Center at Penn Medicine supports The Pulse. Chronic breathing problems can have a devastating effect on a person's quality of life. The Heron Lung Center at Penn Medicine specializes in treating patients with COPD, cystic fibrosis, chronic lung infections, and other advanced lung diseases. Information on the Heron Lung Center is available at pennmedicine.org/breatheeasier or 800-789-PENN. Penn Medicine, because your life, every breath of it, is worth Penn Medicine.
Ben Franklin Technology Partners of Southeastern Pennsylvania supports WHYY's The Pulse and are partners with a purpose, providing capital, counsel, and connections to technology entrepreneurs and investors in the greater Philadelphia area. More about Ben at partnerswithapurpose.org. Independence Blue Cross supports WHYY's The Pulse. Independence is coming to your neighborhood to help you understand healthcare options. Licensed agents can help prepare you for whatever may be ahead. Learn more at ibx.com/events. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.